Okay, any preliminary issues or questions? Okay, we left off, seems like a long time ago, Wednesday, talking about but-for causation, specifically exceptions to the requirement that a plaintiff establish but-for causation. We had just finished working our way through the Sindel case, where the court reviews a variety of different ways that a plaintiff can get around the problem that the plaintiff doesn't know who caused the plaintiff's injury. So the court looks at alternative liability and at concert of action and at enterprise liability and at market share liability, and in each case, well, each of the first three cases finds that the doctrine doesn't fit the case and finally decides that market share liability would be applicable. It left unresolved, however, the question of exactly what type of liability would now be imposed. So that, again, Sindel decides that the plaintiff ought to be able to take advantage of this theory and avoid dismissal of her case just because she can't identify which manufacturer of this drug caused her injury. But it didn't clarify the manner in which a manufacturer would be found liable. And there were, I would say, three different possibilities posed in this sort of Sindel 2.0, Brown versus Superior Court. As I said, I think on Wednesday, there's a separate issue having to do with the standard of liability itself. That is, when a drug manufacturer makes a drug like DES, do we subject them to a form of strict liability as we do for manufacturers of other products, or because of the unique nature of pharmaceutical drugs, should we change that standard and make it in effect more difficult for a plaintiff to recover? That issue is taken up in Chapter 9, again, under the heading of Brown versus Superior Court. What we're worried about here is, assuming we do hold the manufacturer liable, again, what form of liability? And the plaintiff had two alternatives that would provide for a full recovery to the plaintiff. One was the idea that the plaintiff could hold each manufacturer liable regardless of their market share, so long as their market share was one of the factors that contributed to the injury. So let's say we assign defendant A a 10% market share. We assign defendant B a 20% share. Defendant C is assigned a 5% market share. The plaintiff says each of them would be liable for the whole. Now, this is referred to as the doctrine of joint and several liability. And as I've said before, this issue about whether to impose liability for the whole injury on each defendant or whether we should divvy up the individual responsibility of the defendants and limit their liability just to the percentage we think they're accountable for, that very difficult, nuanced issue is essentially, well, it's one of the two major issues in Chapter 6. So we can't do justice to it here, but again, it makes a difference certainly to the plaintiff whether or not the liability of these manufacturers will be essentially for her whole injury or whether she will be stuck, so to speak, collecting separate checks at this banquet, so to speak, in which a significant number of the people who ordered food have left and can't be found for collection. So again, the defendants say, we don't want our liability to be for the whole thing. We want it limited to our percentage share. The plaintiff says, no, I think your liability should be each of you, if each of you, in effect, is part of this problem, you all ought to be on the hook for its solution. The plaintiff had a backup plan, which was if you don't hold each liable for the whole, at least you should take those manufacturers who are found liable. Let's assume we wind up with a total of 70% of the market. The plaintiff says you should, in effect, expand each person's share so that by the time I'm done collecting, I'll have a full recovery. The third alternative, which is the one the defendants proposed, was that the plaintiff's judgment against each defendant would be limited to whatever market share is assigned by the court to that defendant. So that you're essentially, as you go from case to case, each plaintiff gets to recover essentially on the basis of what likelihood there is that her injury was caused by this particular manufacturer. So if Johnson & Johnson Park Davis or Bristol Myers or Squibb or whoever sells pharmaceutical drugs, each of them would, if you find that their share of this market was 5%, they'd each pay the 5% likelihood that that's what caused this particular plaintiff's injury. Now, when the court gets to the point of resolving this issue, they're back in their policy-making mode, as they were in Sindel, to try to figure out kind of the boundaries of the liability system in general. How wide do we want to cast the net of liability, and what sort of boundaries do we think are workable? On the one hand, in Sindel 1.0, they said, we're going to expand the boundary of liability to include not only those defendants the plaintiff can identify, but a sort of percentage likelihood that each defendant is responsible for the plaintiff's injury, even though the plaintiff can't identify which one caused the injury. And then they, instead of saying, well, this is one where we resolve all issues in favor of the plaintiff, they say, in effect, turnabout is fair play. So that just as we looked to the plaintiff's needs in the previous case to decide we're going to make this exception to our ordinary rule of causation, so in deciding the particulars of how this is going to be worked out, we think that each defendant should be liable only for their individual percentage share. That means, of course, that to the extent there are defendants out there that can't be brought into court by the plaintiff, or whose insurance money has run out, or whose stock has dropped to zero, to that extent, the plaintiff will simply go without that much of her compensation. But again, the court's trying to react in a sort of even-handed fashion. The court giveth and the court taketh away, blessed be the name of the court. Again, one of the things to notice as you read these cases is the way in which the court is struggling to come up with something that is, well, we want it to be reasonably consistent, intellectually consistent, doctrinally consistent, but by the same token, we want to make sure that it's reasonably sensitive to the competing needs that both plaintiffs and defendants have. Now, notice what enormous importance is placed upon the determination of these market shares, and think for a minute about how difficult it would be in specific cases to make a meaningful assessment of that market share. Since each defendant's liability will vary according to what they're found to have contributed to, the defendant has a strong motivation to present evidence that will influence the court to reduce their market share, and the plaintiff, by contrast, is going to be looking for ways to make that larger. Think about a case. Suppose Judith Sindel's mother had been living in Spokane when she took this drug. And suppose we had some information about where most of her prescriptions were filled, so that we can piece together, either from Judith's mother's memory or otherwise, well, where did you go when you were pregnant with Judith to get your, where did this drug come from? Did you get it at the hospital pharmacy? Did you get it at Safeway when you bought your groceries? That's where you had your prescriptions filled. Was there a drugstore down the street that you tended to use? Do you have any recollection about this specific drug? Because it might vary enormously from manufacturer to manufacturer. Some manufacturers might sell most of their products to hospitals, and within the hospital setting, their market share is 15%. But among pharmacies attached to grocery stores, their market share was very small. That makes a big difference as to whether you're in this to the tune of 15% or you're basically not in it at all. What about if Judith's mother has some memory of the form in which the prescription came? Was it a pill? What did the pill look like? Gel cap? Tablet? Did you stir it into a drink? Did it come in the form of a syrup? What color was it? If it was a pill, what shape was it? Again, depending on what you could remember about that, it might say, oh, well, our market share of the syrup form was this much. Our market share for gel caps was this other thing. Again, you're going to wind up spending quality time, if you're a litigant in a case like this, fighting over what seems like a pretty picayune detail, but again, since this is the way we've set the problem up, it becomes an extremely important factor for each defendant. So again, as you look at the overall, it's not exactly triggered here, but it's a statistic that sticks in my mind apropos another set of problems, the asbestos cases. I think it was the Rand Corporation that did a study of the way in which the legal system processed claims for asbestos injury. You watch TV, you'll see the ads for, mesothelioma and call this number for your personal injury lawyer. And the way in which asbestos cases had been handled at the time the Rand Corporation did the study, they calculated all the different costs involved, the lawyers, the insurance adjusters, the court personnel, et cetera, and for every dollar spent on an asbestos case, 17 cents wound up in the hands of the victim in the form of compensation. The other 83% was spent on processing the claim. Now, that's not wasted money. It'll help pay your student loans, for example. But from the standpoint of saying, at what point is the tort system doing a good job with cases like this, you begin to say, well, maybe a system that's not quite so perfect in its refinement, that's a little more crude and cut and dried, would actually be better in the long run. Maybe a tax code that's 850 pages long is less desirable than a tax code that's 20 pages long, has some arbitrary features to it, but at least is simpler for people to understand and operate under. So again, as I've suggested here, one of the ongoing questions in all of these toxic tort cases, but in particularly class actions and these sorts of cases, is to figure out, are we really wise to assign this problem to the tort system, or would we be better off with some kind of legislative fix in which you collect a bunch of money in compensation, or you collect a bunch of money from the people that would have been subject to liability, and then you distribute it through some kind of legislative formula. I know, we'll do it like tobacco cases. And again, is that a good model or a bad model for us to follow? Does the tort system may have its flaws, but when you compare it to a political solution, does the political solution have as many problems as the as this other system that you're trying to replace? So again, as I say, the cases are fraught with these larger policy questions, in addition to the doctrinal questions of how we line things up and make them run sort of consistently from a theoretical standpoint. When we actually get down to cases and try to make this system work, how well are we doing? And to the extent that the court is unenthusiastic about the likelihood that it's going to work, the court's going to be in the market for a different kind of solution. Okay, our last case in this market share area is Edwards versus A.O. Leeson Company, which, like Brown versus Superior Court, identifies some of the limitations on the usefulness of this doctrine. Can somebody tell us about Leeson? Edwards versus Leeson. Mr. Simpson. Okay. Now, why? Let's assume that the manufacturers are pretty good candidates for liability here. That they knew this stuff was inferior. They used it anyway to save money. They didn't disclose it. Let's suppose they're on the hook. Why would we care about all these other characters like the wholesalers and the general contractors and so forth? Yeah. I mean, suppose you think your case against the manufacturers is pretty strong, or at least whatever weaknesses there are in that case will be multiplied by the wholesalers and the general contractors who are further down the food chain here. And if you can hold the guys lower down liable, you can certainly hold the manufacturers liable. Why do you need the guys? Why do you need the little fish here? If you potentially have a big fish, what strategic advantage do you get? Anybody have any idea? Is it Madhapur? What do you mean if all else fails? What could fail with your claim against the manufacturer? Okay. That's one possibility that you could gain an advantage legally, Ms. Riley. Okay, we may have a more complete list of players here. Yeah. Okay, it may be that you have a more complete list of players at this lower level, whereas you don't have a complete list at the manufacturer's level. Ms. Rush? But they probably knew less about what was wrong with it than the manufacturers. Mr. Sullivan? OK, Okay. The other strategic advantage is simply that you have more people that, I mean, it's essentially to some extent, it's a shakedown. I mean, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer and you're trying to get compensation, you have a series of defendants. I don't mean to put it in as though it were unscrupulous, but the point is that as many defendants as may be legally liable to you, that's a group of people who say, look, will you take a check for this much and let us out of this? And it may turn out that the manufacturers, as strong as you think your case is legally, the manufacturers may not turn out to have enough money. There may be way too many people who show up at their door looking for compensation, and by the time you're done with your claim, it turns out they don't have anything to pay you with. So plaintiffs look for multiple sources of recovery, even to some extent where they appear to be redundant, where you don't actually need them. And because from the plaintiff's standpoint, if all these people in one way or another didn't do what they were supposed to do and owe me compensation, I'm not simply going to reduce the number I have to the barest minimum. I'm going to hope that all of them are in a mood to make it worth my while to make this thing go away. Mr. Johnson. Well, we don't know that here. I mean, in from the standpoint of this case, what the wholesalers are saying is they want to be they don't want to have this theory applied to them because they say you can't establish the basis of a market share liability theory. And in the absence of being entitled to it, it doesn't matter whether you have a theory against these other people or not. Mr. Simpson, what's the court's ultimate determination of whether market share liability fits the case against the wholesalers? Okay, so in effect, because there are other parties here who can be identified, it's a little bit like Rossellini's concurrence in Sigler versus Kuhlman of saying, in effect, I'm willing to go along with this as a last resort if it's between telling the plaintiff, I'm sorry, you get nothing here, and bending the rules a little bit. Fine, I'll bend the rules and let you recover, but I only do that when I have to, in effect. As long as you have another avenue open to you whereby you can prove your case without the need for this market share liability theory, I don't think we ought to go there, says the court. So again, you're seeing the effect of the policymaking function here of defining the boundary somewhat more narrowly based upon whether this is something needed to get the plaintiff past a sticking point or whether it is redundant. Now, if the plaintiff's able to identify the individual wholesalers and say, this is the pipe that I bought from them, fine, you can go after the wholesaler, but don't ask us to bend the rules as far as but-for causation if you're otherwise able to recover for the loss that you suffered in this case. Moreover, this can be taken care of amongst the defendants to the extent they cross-claim against one another and seek to have somebody else make up for whatever loss they've had to pay. Again, some of this will come back in Chapter 6 where we directly confront the question in multiple defendant cases where more than one defendant is found liable, how do you divvy up the liability? What rules do you want to follow on the one hand that provide a reasonable opportunity for the plaintiff to recover, but at the same time protect a defendant from overpaying where, at least according to them, they are only partially liable for this loss. So again, the court refers back to Sindel saying, yeah, in Sindel we did this market share liability theory in effect because we had to. And here we don't, so we won't. Maybe that's a good public policy, maybe it's bad public policy. My goal in having you read this case is, again, to get some sense that the courts don't always look for the most adventurous way to push the boundaries of the law. We tend to read a lot of cases in which the court is breaking new ground. Those cases tend to be interesting, like Sindel. The court's forced to kind of explain the background to you. They make good teaching vehicles, but it can inadvertently give you the impression that every time the court has an opportunity, they're going to forge boldly into new territory, and that isn't necessarily the case. I don't know. Again, one of the sort of frustrating things about reading cases like this is that you get the court's legal ruling, but you never see the subsequent outcome of it in terms of how the lawyers typically, the way cases end is that the lawyers negotiate some kind of settlement. And that doesn't show up in the case reports. Even if the case goes to trial, the trial itself doesn't show up in the case reports. The only real access we have is through the appellate opinions, which depend upon some legal issue being raised and resolved by an appellate court. Okay, I want to make sure as we make the transition from this section to the next section that we have in mind what problem we're trying to solve. If we get confused about the nature of the problem, we can inadvertently apply the wrong doctrine and think that it's going to help us. But like medical diagnosis, if you don't have a proper diagnosis of the case, you won't be able to come up with a good treatment plan. The problem in these last sets of cases, or this last set of cases, was again that the plaintiff knew somebody had injured the plaintiff, but she couldn't figure out who it was. And as we saw in Sindel, this variety of different proposed alternatives to say, well, even if I can't identify the defendant who caused my injury, this doctrine allows me an exception to that, a sort of dispensation. Now, the next set of cases involves a different kind of problem. We know who the defendant is, but we're having trouble establishing our burden. The plaintiff's having trouble establishing the burden of proximate cause, specifically but-for causation, for a different reason. And just to sort of set the stage for it, without talking about the doctrine of loss of chance itself, but just so you have sort of a mental image of what the problem is, we start with Dillon versus Twin State Gas and Electric. Can somebody tell us about Dillon, Mr. LeBanc? I've skillfully drawn this on the board here, yeah. And let me just say, in some aspects of the case, take us all the way back to the introduction and the turntable and the chemical company cases, where we try to figure out what's the responsibility of a landowner to children trespassing on their property. But let's sort of assume for our purposes that the plaintiff can meet the test, the Chapter 1 test, as it were, of showing that the defendant breached a duty. There's another problem in this case that the court wrestles. But before we get to that, I want to make sure I understand the procedural status of the case. How does the case come to us? Okay. Intestate. That is somebody who died without a will. So by statute, when somebody dies without a will, typically there's a authorization. Okay, these are the people that in effect succeed to the deceased person's estate, so that while you're alive, you can write yourself a will. You can become testate by having a last will and testament. If you die intestate, the state essentially has to make up for you an estate plan, and the parents in this case would be the logical beneficiary or the statutory beneficiary. Okay, so they're suing on the kids, essentially on the kids' behalf. Yeah, logically we would, and it turns out that it makes sense with what else we read in the case, that when they say it ended in a disagreement, they mean the jury couldn't reach a verdict. Now, how did that, first of all, what would we ordinarily do with a case in which the jury couldn't reach a verdict? What's the procedural step that normally follows from a hung jury? Yeah, you have to order a new trial, and obviously I'm sorry, I think that's me here. My apologies. The problem is that in this case, the trial judge orders a new trial, reluctantly, obviously, because it means you have to go through this whole thing again. Meanwhile, the defendant says, not so much that they couldn't be held negligent, they'd still be negligent, but right. The plaintiff's burden is not just to show that the defendant was negligent in putting the wires, electrified wires, in that place, but that the defendant is that negligence proximately caused the plaintiff's injury. And again, by way of review here, proximate cause consists of these two elements, but-for causation on the one hand, legal cause on the other, and the issue we have now is, can the plaintiff persuade a jury? Is there evidence to support a finding that if it hadn't been for the defendant's negligence, more probably than not, the plaintiff would be alive today? The defendant's argument is, more probably than not, the fall would have killed him even if he hadn't been electrocuted. What does the court say to that?
The court says that
Okay. And as we talked about at the very beginning of this section on but-for causation, lots of times it's simply an intuitive judgment by the jury. What does the jury think with respect to but-for causation? Is this a cause without which the injury would not have occurred? Or is this an act of negligence which, regrettable though it was, didn't likely make a difference? Going back to Mitchell versus Gonzalez and the boy who drowns in the lake, was the jury satisfied that this negligence was a cause without which the drowning would not have occurred? Again, it appears in this case, whether it was on the issue of negligence or whether it was with respect to proximate cause, the jury couldn't reach an agreement one way or the other. They were hopelessly deadlocked. And as you say, the court says, we're just going to have to retry the case. Now, I want to be clear on what the normal rule is before we start talking about the exception to the rule. Suppose we did a little bit of investigative work here. We found some crash test dummies, and we took them up to this bridge, and we calculated the wind current or the wind speed on the day of the accident, and we pushed these dummies off in a way that we think simulates what would have happened to this boy. And suppose we do it 100 times, and 60 out of 100 times he lands. Let's say he lands in the water. He lands someplace where we think it's a survivable fall. Badly hurt, maybe permanently disabled, but alive. 40% of the time, we think the fall would have been fatal. That's what we know about this case, let's suppose. What would be the legal outcome, assuming that was a realistic simulation? 60% of the time he lands, he's impaired. McLaughlin? Well, actually, I think you got the numbers reversed there. 60% of the time he would have landed safely. 40% of the time he's dead anyway. Well, going back to Mrs. Reynolds, remember what our test is for Mrs. Reynolds falling down the stairs. Her burden is to satisfy us, more probably than not, she would have made it down the stairs safely if the defendant had used reasonable care. In this case, we say, well, he wouldn't have made it safely, you know, splashing in the water and swimming away, but at least he would have survived. And again, we will postpone till Chapter 3 the question about how you would calculate damages. What's the difference between being dead and being seriously impaired from the standpoint of calculating a monetary award? But assuming we put some number on it someplace, what would the plaintiff recover of that assessment of damages? Is that what we did with Mrs. Reynolds? No, we said she met her burden, she wins. She gets her damages. You've met your test by establishing that more probably than not to a moral certainty, we acknowledge there's some residual chance Mrs. Reynolds would have fallen anyway, even if she'd had adequate light, but we say so long as she meets the test, she wins. By contrast, flip it around and say, suppose the crash test dummy test goes just the other way, and 40% of the time he survives, but 60% of the time he dies anyway. Then what? How much does he get? What's that? Yeah. So it works like a light switch, you know, which is either you flip the light switch on or you flip the light switch off. There's no variation, no dimmer switch, as it were, by which we can say, okay, here's your percentage of recovery, here's how much you get. You either win or you lose. You either meet the test or you don't meet the test. Those are the two options we have. That's the traditional rule. Now, as we'll see in the next case, the plaintiff says, but I don't want the traditional rule. I don't think the traditional rule applied to me operates fairly. And the court then has to decide, do we persist with the traditional rule of saying, here's your burden, you either meet it and win, or you don't meet it and you lose, or should we be a little more creative here in coming up with an alternative? But before we do that, is everybody clear on the way the traditional rule operates, what the plaintiff's burden is? And again, as in Dillon versus Twin States, this burden is placed upon the jury. We ask the jury, what do you folks think? If he had not been electrocuted, do you think he would have survived? If so, tell us what you think the most likely scenario is of this happening. By contrast, if you think if you're not persuaded he would have survived, your verdict should be for the defendant. On, off. Mr. Simpson. Well, that's the difference. In other words, it would simplify our case if there were two options. One is that, you know, we've got these rocks over here, which no one could survive, and you've got water here, which he could land in and swim away safely, so that we don't have the injury part to complicate it. And let's suppose, you know, again, 40, 60 rocks, death, water, swim away, live happily ever after. As it turns out, survival in this case is still survival in an injured condition. So we don't get the full difference between being, alive and living happily ever after and being dead. We get the difference between being dead and being alive but seriously injured. But that differential is not subject to a percentage reduction or percentage allocation. It either is or it isn't, like Mrs. Reynolds going down the stairs. Now, in Hardy, let's go Ms. Monolly. Well, that's, assuming we're exactly down the middle, the plaintiff would fail that test because the test is, or the burden on the plaintiff is to show more probably than not. Tie in this case goes to the defendant. If the jury is not persuaded, we refer to this as the risk of non-persuasion. Whose job is it to get it off that, you know, could go either way? Is it the plaintiff's job to get it off, or is it the defendant's job to get it off that balancing in the middle? And the burden for the basic tort case is, with respect to negligence, causation, and damages, that burden is initially placed on the plaintiff, but, you know, through various things like res ipsa or whatever, you may shift the burden, but ordinarily, the burden starts at least with the plaintiff to satisfy that burden. Yeah. I'm not sure I'm quite tracking the factual scenario. If the defendant was negligent in putting the wire there, maybe this is I don't know if this is what you're talking about or not. But going back to Sindel, suppose the DES drug had been effective as a miscarriage preventive. It turns out it wasn't. But suppose it had been effective, but it also caused injury along the way. You know, in that case, the plaintiff, well, to some extent we have that in the wrongful birth, wrongful life cases. To what extent can you claim injury if in fact the defendant's action is one that arguably puts you in a better place than you would have been if the defendant hadn't acted. So maybe, I don't know, maybe what the kind of scenario you have in mind is the one that we do confront in those cases where the defendant's negligence results actually, at least for some people, in a better deal. For other people, it turns out to be worse, but again, that's part of what we have to wrestle with in the wrongful birth, wrongful life cases. Yeah. Well, again, all of the questions about whether the defendant should be held liable to the extent of did the defendant do anything wrong, what relevance is the trespassing, and so forth and so on, what's their duty to these children, all of that we would hash out in the Chapter 1 kind of issue. Assuming, though, we've decided they did something wrong, we still need to figure out that wrong act caused the injury. Okay, very quickly here with respect to Hardy, can somebody tell us quickly about dialing 911 and getting Garth Brooks tickets here? Maybe with the shortness of time here, I'll just run through it. The plaintiff is the husband of a woman who was having a heart attack. He's frantically, it turns out by a strange coincidence, he himself is a physician, but he needs the ambulance to come get her and get her to the hospital, but he can't get through to the paramedics or the emergency, the ambulance, because the phone system's jammed with people trying to get Garth Brooks tickets. Now, again, it's a Chapter 1 issue with respect to whether the phone company was negligent in setting up a 911 system that didn't have a backup plan or some kind of way to cut through this jam, that you didn't have to stand in line people waiting for Garth Brooks tickets to say, where would you like? No, my wife's having a heart attack. I need medical care. So, but the Chapter 1 issues, again, we leave aside for the moment. Let's assume that, in fact, the phone company was negligent. Their argument is, makes no difference. No offense, but she would have died anyway, says the phone company. Statistics are, for people with her condition, only 40% of them survive with good medical care. So where's the harm? Now, the plaintiff's argument is not so fast, that a traditional rule which left the plaintiff with nothing if the defendant could show that the plaintiff's chance going in was not particularly good, was not above 50%, this would, in effect, allow defendants to be careless with respect to significant chances of recovery, which, alas, fell below 50%. And the plaintiff points out, we've done this in the medical context. It turns out that with respect to medical malpractice, if you have a condition where you only have, let's say, a 30% chance of recovering the use of your shoulder by some kind of shoulder surgery, if the doctor negligently fails to give you that treatment or bungles the treatment in such a way that there was no chance of getting that potential 30% possibility of recovery, in a medical malpractice case, the plaintiff can recover the value of that chance. So let's say the loss of your shoulder is worth $100,000. If the plaintiff had a 30% chance, which was lost by the defendant's negligence in a medical malpractice case, the plaintiff gets a $30,000 recovery. That's the loss of a chance theory as applied to medical cases. What's going on in Hardy is the problem of figuring out, but will we do that when the defendant is the phone company rather than a medical provider? So why don't we pick up with that tomorrow to figure out what the courts are going to do.